Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is reporter George Nixon. And coming up, more lapdog than watchdog. A criminal investigation is underway following the collapse of London Capital and Finance, with many questions being asked, including of the city regulator itself. Simon explains all, including what is an innovative ISA and why is it risky. Also today, George argues for young workers to get started investing, but 16? We look at when it doesn't pay to book early and whether insurers will pay out when bad driving goes viral. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.
But first, the city regulator is itself to be investigated by the Treasury following the collapse of London Capital and Finance last month. Now, did the Financial Conduct Authority do enough to protect the almost 12,000 customers who'd invested £236 million in LCF? There are fears they may only recover around 20% of that. But this case throws up all sorts of issues, not just the conduct of those at LCF and the FCA, but about regulated companies selling unregulated products, the marketing of them to the public, that maybe just don't get the intricacies. So, a warm welcome to you both. Simon, remind us what happened. Who are LC&F?
Well, London Capital and Finance were a company that set up offering savers returns of about 8%. And the idea was that you would invest with this company, then your money would be lent out to small businesses, and it would be using something called mini bonds. Mini bonds are so called because they are a bond, an IOU, where you are lending a company money and it pledges to repay you your capital and some interest. And mini bonds, to differentiate them from something called retail bonds, which are a bond that is traded on the Order of Retail Bonds Index run by the London Stock Exchange. So those are actually traded on an index. You can buy and sell them in the same way that you buy and sell shares. There are market makers who've pledged to buy and sell bonds off people so that the market is liquid. And as you would imagine, for something to go onto a London Stock Exchange index, etc., etc., there's a reasonable amount of rules that those companies have to follow, prospectuses that they have to put out in a certain way. Mini bonds, on the other hand, are a bit more loose in their issuance. We could probably sit down
loose
and decide.
In common parlance?
Well, I mean, we could probably put our heads together and decide that we wanted to set up a mini bond business.
Okay.
And then sort of buy some off the shelf stuff and get it started. And
loose seems rather a generous word then for
Yeah. I mean, it was slightly more complicated than that, but sometimes you get the suspicion that it's not that much more complicated. There's been an awful lot of companies that have sprung up offering these mini bonds, and they range from established companies on the high street that you might know about. For example, the restaurant Chilango has been issuing something called burrito bonds there to encourage people to invest and help fund the expansion of Chilango, and people will get paid some money. Now, it should be mentioned that there are numerous mini bonds that people have taken out where they have made money and got a return and got their money back. And that actually, if you were to invest in these things and say you built up a portfolio of them, at least 10 businesses that all do different things were aware that your capital was at risk and you might not get it back, and worked on the basis that out of those 10 that you invested in, probably at least one will go bust, then maybe it's not a bad part of your investment portfolio. But that's part of your investment portfolio, and that's 10 of them that's just making up that one small part. The problem is people have seen adverts with language around savings, language around interest, language around potentially guaranteed rates of return sometimes. They see FCA regulated. As it has emerged, not all of the stuff that's going on is FCA regulated. It might just be that one of the companies involved is FCA regulated.
And this was the case here, wasn't it?
Sometimes they see that part of there might be something that's got FCS compensation, but it's not FSCS compensation in the way that we know it with the savings account, where your capital up to £85,000 is protected. And they think these are much safer products and much more suited to their kind of saving rather than investing that they do. And unfortunately, £237 million belonging to 11,500 savers went into London Capital and Finance, and it went bust, and it turns out it hasn't really done what it's meant to have done. It was going to lend money to lots of small businesses. The administrators have said the money's just gone to 12 companies, which it described as not independent. So it's all a bit of a mess.
Sounds it. George, yes. What is the FCA supposed to be doing about it? Why criticism here?
So the FCA had quite a busy Monday afternoon and made a lot of financial journalists have a busy Monday afternoon for other reasons that we'll come on to later. But this what it said is, there's an independent two-part investigation into the collapse of London Capital and Finance. One aspect of it is it's investigating itself, essentially, into its supervision of London Capital and Finance. So, for example, the FCA froze the accounts of LCF in December 2018. It described the marketing of LCF as not fair and misleading. Again, as Simon pointed out about the language about savings and interest and how it was listed on price comparison sites alongside actual savings accounts. The company, which was called, I think was called Surge, there's been a lot of investigation into that, and that made £60 million off of commission from LCF. Around 25% of all the money that was deposited into LCF came on the back of referrals made by Surge, I believe. Okay. But LCF had been taking deposits for about 3 years by the time the FCA finally got around to freezing its accounts. So the investigation is into its own supervision of LCF. Second part of it, as Simon talked about, mini bonds, risky, loose, is whether existing regulation adequately protects casual investors from the potential harm, is the word I used, of mini bonds. LCF itself was authorised by the FCA, but the mini bonds themselves that it was selling were not. As you can imagine, people perhaps justifiably would see FCA approved, big stamped all over the company's website, and think that's fine, you know, that's safe, and the mini bonds were not. So there's been a string of stories. So the administrator's report came out last week. Smith and Williamson, who are doing the corporate post-mortem of it, as Simon said, it lent to a very limited number of companies, many of whom were not independent from LCF. So, for example, £12.6 million went towards a stable with 50 horses. £70.1 million went to holiday developments in the Dominican Republic and Cornwall, and £12 million went to one in Cape Verde. These are not small businesses, right? The administrators have called some of these transactions highly suspicious and have called on four men who are connected to LCF to pay the money back for the benefit of those people who lost their savings.
It's interesting to mention as well that the administrator said that despite being loaned £27 million, the two companies in Cape Verde did not have legal rights to any land. Then also, one of the other absolute winners in here is that LCF lent £840,000 to its parent company, London Financial Group, to buy a helicopter. The idea was that it would sell it onto an American company for a quick profit. Once the helicopter had been bought, it became clear that the US company had only ever wanted to charter the aircraft and not buy it. So there's some bona fide, serious business dealing going on behind the scenes here. I mean,
so I noticed on LinkedIn a comment from Gina Miller, who is famous for wanting, is it Sunlight Remedy on lots of investing issues? And so it's hardly surprising that she's calling for huge changes to take place at the FCA. Do you think that she's right? Do changes need to be made? Do changes need to be made at the top? Is this a huge failing or a lapdog or a watchdog, I think it was called? Or is this, because some financial firms can be quite obscure, can we put it that way, that actually you can understand things will be missed? Or is this just inexcusable?
Look, I get what's going on here, OK? This is a new element of finance, OK? This is essentially putting together companies that want to borrow money with investors that want to lend it out. And it involves cutting out an element of middlemen. The middlemen being cut out are the sort of, you know, the established financial players. And instead, you can go, I've got £1,000 and I'm willing to lend it to you, and you're going to pay me 8% interest, which is much better than I'm going to get in the bank, more than I'm going to get on a dividend, and you're going to give it back to me at the end. Okay, fine, I'll do that. But I don't think that most people are able to properly assess the risk that they are taking, whether that 8% is high enough. Because actually, you know what? Loads of these companies that are being lent this money through many of these mini bond things, I'd want probably 12% because they're involved in risky ventures that are likely to potentially go bust. an 8% is quite high, but people see 5%. I think, well, 5% is a lot better than what I'm getting in my savings account. But it's like, maybe you should be asking 8%. Maybe you should be asking 10%. Are people evaluating this against what they would get from a corporate bond fund, where you've got a manager who assesses these companies properly? And then also, I think the issue is, the more to do with the FCA issue, is that there's been a huge explosion in the advertising for these companies in recent years, and we've seen lots of them that we've written about and flagged that we are concerned about the way that they are advertising, the things that they are targeting. They're often targeting savers. They're often targeting this middle ground between saving and investing, because a lot of these people are not coming out of the consumer finance world. They're not coming out of the sort of consumer facing fund management, investing platform, savings world. They're coming out of property development. They're coming out of financial engineering. They're coming out of maybe even the tech space. And what you're finding is they don't see any problem with this promoting it to savers and calling it a middle ground and that kind of thing, and the advertising language that they're using. They don't understand why that's an issue. They're not necessarily, some of them are not necessarily deliberately doing anything wrong. Whereas if you talk to anyone from the other side of it, who's spent years dealing with the limits and the ways that you are allowed to communicate with customers and what you have to be careful about saying here and there so as not to mislead people, they're horrified at some of these adverts that they're seeing. And the FCA, to be honest, doesn't really appear to have been paying an awful lot of attention to this. It's been doing the kind of light touch regulation thing for this nice new shiny bit of finance, but it doesn't seem to have grasped how people behave, and the fact that when you put all the different bits of the jigsaw together, at the end of this, you've got ordinary savers putting their money into companies that they don't understand the risk of what they're putting their money into. And unfortunately, in this situation, they've lost a lot of money. And there are people who have lost their life savings. There are people who have put 10 or 20,000 pounds, all of their savings that they've got, into this thing that they thought was low risk, they thought it was safe, they thought it, some of them have even said they thought it was guaranteed, and said they didn't understand it, and that they saw various things there. And one of the things that they saw was the letters FCA and ISA, and they thought, oh, that's okay, It must be official. It's an observable phenomenon that loads of ordinary people who couldn't understand what they were putting their money into have lost lots of money. So yeah, I think there is a failing that needs to be investigated.
As I say, you can totally understand that with you. ISAs are supposed to be safe. We're always told ISAs are
it's
safe.
Kind of, people see it as a rubber stamp. They don't
get
it.
Yes, exactly.
They don't know that that doesn't mean anything.
It just
means
tax wrapper, doesn't it? But people, obviously, it is that there's a confers a kind of legitimacy.
An official,
doesn't it?
Yeah, that's official. That's legit, as you just said.
Final word to you, George. What needs to change here? Will anything change as well?
Well, it's interesting. You talk about ISAs, and this kind of dovetails a little bit with the innovative finance ISA. And one thing you can see about the FCA, there's criticism for being too light touch, is that now it's actually, like I said, it made us all very busy on Monday afternoon. It put out a statement to do with innovative finance ISAs, saying that we've seen evidence that these are being promoted alongside cash ISAs. Investments are generally high risk, with the money being invested in products like mini bonds or peer-to-peer investments. These types of investments may not be protected by the FCA, so customers may lose the money invested or find it hard to get back. Anyone considering investing in an IFISA should carefully consider where the money is being invested before purchasing one. So perhaps it's just covering its back based on the collapse of LCF, and it thinks, well, maybe a couple of others will go, and we need to make sure that we appear to be doing something.
They've obviously been looking at this for, I imagine, for some time. There must have been concerns raised. You've raised concerns about this. Actually, it's the government to blame. I hate saying that. But it is the idea that, you know, we've got so many of these ISAs now. Should we have just called it something else? Should we just get rid of it altogether?
Don't know, because obviously you've got an investment ISA, and an investment ISA, you know, if you're buying into a company that's listed on the AIM stock market, then you know the risks and you know that it could go bust. I just think it's some of the language around the advertising. So I don't necessarily think it's a problem with the ISA. I think maybe they might need to make it a little bit tougher for people to be able to offer an ISA.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the key things, though, that I would say for anybody who is considering investing in mini bonds or anything like that is it might pay off. And I'm not necessarily saying it's a bad thing. I think I hopefully made it clear earlier in the podcast that actually I think that some of this is quite interesting if you build up a portfolio of these things. But you have to be aware that this entire peer-to-peer mini-bond, innovative finance, ISA space has not been tested through the business cycle. Mm-hmm. It has emerged since the financial crisis. It's been through the uptick. It's not been through a recession. And if you are investing into mini-bonds that, for example, are backing property development, which many of them are, then when the property market slumps, you're going to see problems and people are going to go bust. And it might be that there's an underlying asset that's secured on, for example, a property, but that property might have to be sold at fire sale prices and it might take a long time to sell.
So an element of going in with your eyes wide open and doing your homework first. Yes. OK, we're talking about homework. Kids. Kids nowadays, Simon. Working hard, saving money, thinking about investing, eh? Times have changed. But you have a query from a savvy 16-year-old who's saved $2,500 over the last 2 years since they started working. Half has gone into a help to buy ISA, and they want to use a portion of the rest to dip their toe in the investing water, quote, to get some experience. So they've got age on their side, and I guess they're a bit less risk-averse than some. So, George... 16? I'm not picking on you because you are the closest to 16 in the studio, which is true.
I am This Is Money's resident Generation Zedder, in fairness. So.
I don't even know what that means, no. Which says a lot about my age. But you did actually look into this.
I did.
So we'll get onto the specifics in a minute. But it got your brain whirring. You actually penned an article off the back of this. Quote, I might be more bargain bucket than Warren Buffett, but I'm glad I invest and other young workers should get started too. So, tell us what you wrote about and what do you mean? I'm more bargain bucket than Warren Buffett.
Well, I mean, apart from the fact that it's, you know, wordplay.
Give it time. Wordplay.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is true. Yeah. Essentially, I was thinking about Lee Boyce, friend of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Assistant editor Lee Boyce.
Assistant editor Lee Boyce was talking to me about potentially writing a column piece on why young people should consider investing and opening stocks and shares ISA.
How old are you, George?
I am 22.
Oh, bless. Okay.
Yeah,
you
I know,
really right? are close. To
yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was thinking about doing it anyway, and this comment from a reader and podcast listener. So you know, there you go, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sort of kicked me into overdrive and actually made me get my act together and, like I said, go through the paperwork and find out my own investing history and basically, again, write a piece explaining why it's probably a better idea long-term than savings.
Your investing history at 22. Indeed. Tell me about your investing history.
Yes. Well, I suppose the point I was trying to make is that it's not really my investing history. So I was lucky enough that my parents set up this thing that used to be called the Rupert Fund, kind of Invesco Perpetual thing, child savings for years and years and years. So when I turned 18, my dad set up a stocks and shares ISA on my behalf, split the money into thirds and put a third in each fund and that sort of thing. So I actually went back and looked at the paperwork and see how it had done, and even adjusting for stock market slumps and, you know, putting more money in as a result of starting work and leaving university, the return I got percentage-wise far exceeded anything I would have got by putting it in a savings account, mm-hmm. which is quite an eye-opener. I also now take a more active interest in actually what I invest in, and I have a greater knowledge of it now. But the point I was trying to make was less a kind of case of blow my own trumpet and more a...
Well, I'd say blow your dad's trumpet for sorting that out.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Well, that was, I suppose, the point. And that the only reason it took me 4 years between it being opened and me actually sort of understanding what was going on with it was because, you know, I didn't really take an interest. And it's a point that it's not as hard as it seems. If you can get into it at 16, and the younger you get in, the better. It can be quite jargony, but it's, you know, it's not
but what I like
too
is that
difficult.
Realization for you that it would have got much better returns than had you just left.
Exactly, and that was the kind of fundamental point that if you are looking to save long term, whatever that will be for, and this is the key is long term, as I'm sure you've gone on and on and on about on this podcast.
All right, on and on and on. So,
well, you know what I mean.
Yeah. We have discussed it at length.
Discussed it at length, yeah.
So you're talking about the benefits, and absolutely. But 16, tell us about your very savvy 16-year-old.
My very savvy 16-year-old. Yeah, so his question was simply, I'd quite like to get into investing. Mm-hmm. How do I get started? He said maybe there's no real specific goals for it,
But he does have a specific portion, a sort of 50 to 100 pounds a month. Yeah. And...
yeah. Well, what we said to him was, house buyers are great if you're looking to buy a house in the next few years. Probably not the best bet if you're looking to invest long term, which you would be at 16. You can invest in a junior ISA. At 16, you can have it opened for you. If you're under 18, you can have a junior ISA opened for you by your parents. At 16, you can then take much more authority over what is done with the investments. So therefore, it allows you to dip your toe in because you've got, you know, the ISA allowance is smaller. It's £4,260 for this tax year rather than £20,000.
But you'd be well covered for.
Yeah, of course.
He's not putting that much in.
No.
But it does allow you then, does it? Because when you think of a junior ISA, you think...
cash savings.
Yeah, it wouldn't allow you to be quite so experimental, which is what your reader and what our listener wants from this.
Yeah, that's right. And you can't. There's no right or wrong time to get into investing. So I mentioned Lee earlier. Lee's opened a stocks and shares ISA for his newborn daughter. Mm-hmm. Obviously not a junior ISA, because he wants to have more authority on it, but his daughter is technically an investor, right? It's all gone into a Vanguard Life.
It's extraordinary, because she's not 16, she's about 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. So I suppose it's true, there is no sort of, I guess, too early time to get into investing, Simon.
No, indeed, Simon. And there's lots of considerations as well there. Like George says, how hands-on do you want to be as a parent, or, you know, as a 16-year-old, which platforms, which investments do you choose?
Yes, and what I would say is, you know, you can start off simple. You could just invest in, you know, maybe one or two funds. That's probably the easiest way to do it. Pool your money with other people. It could be that you just invest in the whole stock market through a tracker fund, or you might decide that you want to back a particular fund manager whose job it is to pick the best investments for you. Yeah, get started. Dip your toe in. £50 to £100 a month is what's being talked about here, because the person is working. Now, it might be that they continue with work and they can continue with that £50 to £100. It might be that they don't do so much work because they're in full-time education. Perhaps they go to university or something. Maybe they can keep the money going in over the time, keep an eye on their investments. I'm sure that many parents, if their child said to them, well, you know what, I've actually been saving this money and then I've started investing some money, and while I'm off at uni, I'm not going to have any money, would you put in the £50 a month for me while I'm there? I think many parents would go, yeah, I definitely will do that for you.
And on the point of parents' nest eggs, actually, you reminded me of something I'd slightly forgotten, which is that every child born between 2001 and 2011, no, 2002 and 2011, is eligible, had something open for them called a Child Trust Fund, which was actually replaced by the Junior ISA, and there will likely be a bit of money stored in that.
There's a huge amount unclaimed, isn't there?
I would imagine so, and the government paid a grant to each of these ones, so you will likely, if you were born in that period of time, go hunt that down first. If you just Google how to find my Child Trust Fund, there's easy ways to find it, and you can use that money almost... if you don't have any other savings to put into investing, you can use that. If you do, you can, you know, you've got a little bit of bonus cash that you might not otherwise have known about. So that's a quick tip before you even think about getting started as well.
Yeah. And I mean, and if you do start young, then chances are you're going to continue. You're going to probably continue saving and investing through your adult life. Once you start working full time, you're going to be more likely to think about your pension. Basically, you're going to set yourself up for much greater success and to be wealthy in the future. So hats off to any young people who are doing it.
It's definitely the truth as well, in terms of the hardest part is getting started. Like I said, what I've found personally is that, you know, it's all a lot smoother now and it's a lot more enjoyable, actually.
There you go. Ringing endorsement.
Indeed.
Lots more information about that, as I said, which platforms, investments, some fund ideas to get you started on your article, George.
Yep.
But one thing that a lot of people think about, Simon, though, when you invest is the fees. Often puts people off. So would you be tempted if you could buy and sell shares for free? Well, Trading 212 and Free Trade offer fee-free share dealing to take on the likes of Hargreaves Lansdown et al. So, Simon, explain all.
Yes. Why would you offer people the chance to buy and sell shares for free when other people charge you £10 or £12 for the privilege? Well, these two companies are doing this, and essentially it's a kind of loss leader thing. It's to pull in more customers for them both. Trading 212 has been around for longer, and it actually, its main business is a kind of trading business. Contracts for difference trading, CFDs. CFDs are essentially a derivative. You're not buying shares or buying into a market. You're buying something that mimics its moves. There's a bit of a crackdown going on CFDs, so there's definitely an incentive for trading 212 to move more into the investing space. But actually, its offer of free share dealing kind of predates that anyway. And it just sees it as a space that it wants to get into, and it wants to get customers in by offering them free share dealing and then make some more money off them off the back of something else. Because the obvious question you have to ask for any business that is offering something for free is, well, how are you going to make money? Then Free Trade, which is a newer service, has launched, and that is offering free share dealing. It doesn't do anything else. It has plans to expand its business, but it's going to be more of an investment business. What it does do, though, is charge you £3 a month if you want to have an ISA, but it's free if you're just trading normally. But what you do is you have something called a batch trade, where they pull together all of the share trades and then they do them all at a certain time of the day, and that helps to cut the costs for them. If you want to buy and sell shares instantly and get a set price, then you can pay a small amount of money in order to make that trade. Both of them have less shares on offer than the big investment platforms, the Hargreaves Lansdowns, etc. of this world. However, obviously, they also charge less money. So I think it's an interesting concept. It's probably going to work better for the kind of investor who wants to be buying and selling shares all the time, but isn't necessarily so bothered in terms of doing so through their ISA. Because if they've got an ISA, then what they're probably also going to want to do is hold other investments that they're not going to be able to access through these two services. But if you are someone who is interested enough doing the research and playing the stock market, then it's not a bad idea and could probably save you quite a lot of money, because all of those £10 share dealing fees add up quite a lot over the year. And the closest one on offer to this free service in terms of price is iWeb, which only charges a fiver to buy and sell shares. But even then, £5 is quite a lot more than nothing.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.
Now, away from all that, you have a query from a reader who I think is over 16. I'm not sure. But it relates to an issue that certainly crosses my mind. Whenever I see something that's encouraging me to book early to get a discount, I hate that. Is it genuine or is it just a marketing ploy? Well, you have a case of a holiday booking that dates back to November with TUI to Fuerteventura for this month, so April 2019. Now, the discount offered last year is not only still there, but it's actually £300 cheaper. So I can totally understand your readers' concerns about this and wanting that £300. They contacted TUI and TUI basically said, tough. Obviously, I've paraphrased there, Simon. What was the real issue? What did they really say?
According to TUI, when there are less than five of a particular room type left, it will display a message notifying the customer there is limited availability, which it said helps preventing disappointment of the holiday no longer being available to their customers. Got nothing to do with trying to flog holidays.
Not at all.
Nothing to do with it. It's to help you out so you don't get disappointed. While it seems unusual that five rooms are still available after a few months, it is possible. Of course, the holiday industry has been absolutely decimated by Brexit, and we had EasyJet warning this week that not only had it seriously dented Easter with nobody going on holiday at Easter because we were meant to be leaving on the 29th of March. You may note that we didn't.
Thank you.
But now it's affecting summer holidays. People aren't booking summer holidays because of it. And that's EasyJet, which says that it, whatever happens, even if there's no deal Brexit, it will be flying as usual. Mm. People aren't really believing this, though. And they're like, it only takes the French air traffic controllers to play silly buggers. And yes, I'll be spending hours waiting at the airport, etc. So it's not completely unlikely. But a TUI spokesman said, we're sorry to hear this customer is unhappy on this occasion. TUI uses a dynamic pricing model, which means that our prices can go up or down. And this is stated in our terms and conditions. There are many variables which have to be taken into account, including peak dates of travel, regional airport differences, and which channel our customers book through. We'd like to reassure customers that wherever possible, we offer the best value for money and discounts to TUI and first choice customers throughout the year, even in peak periods, as an incentive to book. We encourage our customers, particularly those that need to travel during the school holidays, to book early. This allows them to secure the property and destination of their choice while there is still availability. I think they're sort of missing the point here. Basically, what this person is saying is, hang on a minute, this was meant to be on sale and limited availability, so I booked it well in advance. Now it's cheaper. Why can't I just cancel it and rebook it at the cheaper price? They can't just cancel it and rebook it at the cheaper price because there's cancellation fees. I do think that if you book something in advance, you normally get the best price, but you do also know that a last-minute booking tends to be cheaper. In this instance, I believe that this they are not now looking at it last minute. There's still quite a long time to go. But it does show how booking holidays and flights has become... Whilst it has become considerably cheaper and easier thanks to the internet, it has also become something of a lottery.
Yeah.
The point that Grace, I think, made in the story was that there was a case where EasyJet used to do a kind of price match thing where if the price did go down, they would give you vouchers for the difference or, you know, discount you the difference. And I think it's quite a common thing in other areas of consumer spending for you to pay a price for something and then if there is a lower price elsewhere to be refunded the difference. So I'm not entirely sure why it couldn't necessarily apply to holidays.
But it sort of locks in that price. They don't have any flexibility as a company with which to reduce it further or indeed raise it. I mean, if they can't cancel our contracts, if they put up the price... Why should we cancel it when they put down the price? Because of a number of reasons could have happened between November and April. Brexit,
yeah,
delays.
That's true. And I think what the reader was complaining about more was misleading signals.
Yeah.
There's been this report into this recently, hasn't there? It was a CMA, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Into things like booking.com and stuff. And there was things like you're looking at a hotel, for example, and it says five people have booked this in the last 24 hours. Now you think, oh my God, five people have booked it. I need to go away on these dates. I need to book this because five people have booked it. That doesn't actually mean that five people have booked that hotel for the period that you were looking to travel. That just means five people have booked that hotel at any time, ever, in the last 24 hours.
That needs to stop.
And it's
all
some
of
this misleading stuff going on. And you get the same thing when you're looking at flights and various other things. And it's pressure. It's a nudge. It's trying to encourage you to book. It's psychology, isn't it? And if you understand the psychology, then you can try to be a bit more relaxed. But it's meant to make you nervous. It's meant to make you on the edge of your seat. If we give an honourable mention to someone formerly of the This Is Money Parish, Rachel Rickard-Strauss here, she did defend this, I believe, by saying that she realised that this was slightly wrong. She did quite like it because... she'd always procrastinate about booking things and then invariably she'd wish she'd actually booked them. So the nudge in the right direction was quite a good thing. And that normally it turned out that actually, but if she'd have just booked it the first time round when she thought about it, it would have been cheaper than it was by the time she booked it anyway.
Sort of the same there, but also you are playing the holiday lottery. You have no idea. That says more about her procrastination and leaving it until the absolute last minute when everything's sold out, I think.
I think that there's a business there, isn't there? Like, we should start it up. Holiday lottery. Basically, it's complete lottery holiday business where you just put in the details that you're willing to travel and you get a holiday, but you don't even get told where you're going. You just get told to turn up at an airport.
There's a couple that do that already, right?
Yeah, but that's secret escapes. You always find out where you're going and you can find all those things where they claim it's secret. You can actually find out where you're going. This is proper holiday lottery.
Well, on the subject of it being a lottery, I went to Bilbao at the start of March and I went one week. It was lovely, wasn't it? I went the second week of March rather than the third week of March because there was a £150 difference between the flights between Thursdays, which I thought was, again, very strange.
Like an Easter holiday, summer
holiday? I have absolutely no idea. There was no logical explanation for it.
It's not the school holidays. The thing is, right, what I think George is saying is that it was the difference between travelling on the 13th of March and the 20th of March.
That's
correct?
That's
right. So the 20th of March, which is the more expensive one, is not the school holidays. The school holidays for most kids start tomorrow. For kids at private school, they started last week. So you would have expected maybe the Thursday before the 29th of March to be busy. But what's going on there is you also get a phenomenon where the school holidays manage to skew flight prices outside of the school holidays because people go, I want to go away, but I don't want to go in the school holidays. Let's go the weekend before they start or two weekends before they start. So you get random weeks where the effect of the school holidays manages to skew flight prices, even though they're nowhere near the school holidays.
Well, there you go. You learn something new every day. Finally, you may have seen a video doing the rounds on social media of a Lamborghini crash in London, which has begged the question that your motoring correspondent, Rob Hull, has answered. Do insurers pay out on claims made by motorists when their careless antics have gone viral? Simon, let us know the answer.
Yes. Well, the other week, there was footage that emerged of, and it was after a supercar event, street in West London, a residential street. Well, it's kind of some business parks and stuff, but there's people standing around watching, and a guy appeared to use the launch control. Launch control is something designed in supercars to be used on track so that you basically can accelerate from a standing start as quickly as possible in a drag race, to head off down the road at what appeared to be a speed that was high enough to be breaking the speed limit. He then managed to lose control of his Lamborghini and put in a little wiggle before taking a sudden sharp left straight into a wall and causing a substantial amount of damage to said Lamborghini that looked like the Lamborghini had been written off. The video, which had been filmed by an onlooker, went viral. It was all over the internet. It was all over Twitter. It was all over all the websites. Yeah. I mean, he bins it. He bins it properly there.
I know where that is as well. He used to live near there. Oh, dear. Oh, yes. It doesn't look pretty. This makes for great podcasting, by the way. But if you do get an opportunity, have a look. It doesn't go very far.
Just Google the words Lamborghini crash. You'll find it. It'll be the top result. Now, the thing is, the most painful element of that was expressed by a number of people watching it were, oh, he's binned his Lamborghini.
£200,000 Lamborghini.
And the insurance isn't going to pay out for that, is it? Because he's obviously at fault. He's obviously been driving dangerously. Now, we spoke to a couple of insurers and they said it's not actually so cut and dry. Now, it's not entirely clear that he's definitely done something illegal, right? You can't necessarily prove that he's driving dangerously or that he's driving dangerously in a way that would invalidate his insurance, which is what the insurance companies have said. So a number of them said, no, actually, we probably would pay out.
Wow.
And one of them said, maybe we wouldn't. Yeah.
Well, that's, so there you go. That's relief for you all of us in this studio you would think when we next smash our $200,000 Lamborghini.
Now, what I think that is very, very wrong with this scenario.
Right.
Okay, is that also,
apart from his driving,
a lot of insurers are now making it very clear that they will not pay out if you have left your keys in the car. For example, you've left the engine running to go do something, or you have a keyless car and you've left the key in it and someone's gained access to it, or you haven't locked your car. Okay, so for example, it's very easy to not lock a keyless car. It used to be, in the old days, when you had to stick the key in the car door and turn it, it's pretty simple. Turn around, beep the bipper. For some reason, there's a door not shut properly or something you don't notice, hasn't locked properly. There's lots of insurers saying that they won't pay out. So it would seem slightly unfair if you were someone who managed to get their car stolen for that accidental purpose that your insurer didn't pay out, but they did pay out to the guy who binned his Lamborghini. We don't know who the insurer is for this particular Lamborghini and whether it will be paid out. And we also do not know for certain that the man was driving dangerously. But Google it and then you can decide whether he was yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you want to get in contact with us,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got something that you want us to investigate. Tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find the archives of the podcast and join in the debate in the reader comments.
Do indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving your little ones a head start with our junior ISA.